listening to Magic From Wherever I'm At with your host, the magician, time traveler, and charmer, D'Artagnan.
Welcome to another edition of the podcast. I am D'Artagnan, and today is a very near and dear episode to my heart. This will be a two-part episode. And a few months back, somebody on the internet asked me a question of who I thought were the greatest magicians of all time. And I answered that one person I thought who deserves status among the greatest of all time was the person we will talk about today. Now, I will freely admit that I'm biased in favor of this person, for one reason being that if I had not encountered this person on a VHS tape back when I was about 28, I would probably never have gone into magic at all. He is a fellow Canadian, a fellow Ontarian, both of us having been born in Ontario. And we share a few other things together, I would say, which are simple coincidences. But I don't think he particularly needs defending, as he has a long and storied list of accolades, including, I believe, being voted the most impactful magician of the 20th century. So today and next week, we're going to talk about David Frederick Winfield Vernon, a.k.a. Dave Vernon, a.k.a. The Professor. Now, when this person asked me the question on the internet, the answer I gave was that the reason I believed Vernon should be among the very best of the very best, the status among the elite of magicians in history, wasn't necessarily because of skill or artistry in the performances. But basically, I took a different tact with the answer, one I think most people would not give, which was, I believe that Vernon was the very best, perhaps whoever lived, at presentation.
Oh la la!
But not in the specific sense that I'm normally talking about it on this podcast, which is for your individual tricks or the arc of your overall show, or the way everything is woven together into some sort of thematic and character-building element, most of which doesn't exist in any magic show that most people don't put the work in to actually do under any circumstance in the modern age. But Vernon, if you were to step back and look at his whole life from a sort of different angle, a different perspective, you will soon realize that Vernon's entire life in magic was essentially a superb presentation. And he was simply the best, I feel, at weaving stories and drawing, you know, teaching points out of the very many vast experiences he had in his life, traveling around, meeting weird people. In essence, he was a magician's magician solely because he lived such a weird, you know, bohemian lifestyle. Much of which street magicians, I would say, emulate and or sort of do themselves, where his whole life was magical. I mean, he took a real job for just a very minuscule few days or a week or something, where he ended up breaking his arms on a job site. And other than that, didn't have a real job his entire life. He cut silhouettes, which was a thing known in the, you know, in the world back then. And he performed magic. And one of the things I've often heard about from other performers who were not particularly Vernon people, let's say, was that he wasn't a professional performer. He wasn't a great performer. And I'm going to call that under dispute here today, because I think there's been a number of things that most people I've heard that from either never heard before or don't truly understand the story behind what happened in Vernon's life. And when I went back to look and learn more about Vernon, knowing quite a deal about him already, having read most of the major things published about Vernon, I found out some very interesting details that I had either forgotten or was never uncovered before during my research. Now, like I said, I think Vernon's whole life was one, you know, he was just the very best at presentation, which I think is the most important skill. And if you look at the bridge he became between the what they call the Golden Era, you know, the Thurstons, the Kellers, the early part of the 1900s, to the, you know, what I'd call the modern era, which probably started in the 30s and 40s and all the way up to when Vernon passed away. I think he was 98, so he lived a very long time. You know, he became that bridge between the old school magic and essentially what magic has become, the close-up magic. And you can perhaps poo-poo that in a way if you think close-up magic is kind of a degradation in a way of magic. Because, you know, parlor and stage and stuff maybe has taken a backseat somewhat, because the close-up magic has become sort of the marketplace of magic, if you will. And that was largely ushered in during Vernon's lifetime, right? And he was certainly a part of all that, selling books and so forth and tricks. However, when you look at exactly what Vernon did, I mean, he probably was the most persuasive magician who ever lived. I mean, he never had a real job. He ended up in residency at the Magic Castle, where everything was taken care of essentially for him. I mean, just think about that for a second. Now, a lot of people poo-poo Vernon for being, and rightfully so, I would say, for being a bad family person and a terrible father and not looking after the financial means of his family. And there are certainly he certainly seemed to be very bad at that at times, and kind of just didn't care about that. Not didn't care about his family per se, maybe, but certainly didn't care about money very much. Seemed to spend it very freely when he did have it, and other times was unconcerned about bills and rent and so forth. But also, if you turn and look at that from a different perspective, like I said earlier, he never had a real job. If it was cutting silhouettes or doing magic, and usually it was both, incidentally, then, you know, who is so persuasive that they never have a real job? Right? I mean, who in their life is so persuasive and convincing and so good at presenting themselves, their knowledge, and so forth, that people want to put them up in a castle and pay for everything for the rest of their life so they can access that person on a daily basis? I mean, that has never happened, basically, to anybody else. And from that perspective, you could say that Vernon was the greatest at persuasion in magic and at storytelling, charm, charisma, you know, all of which are skills, basically, he possessed. And it's well documented throughout the literature and from people who knew him how charming he was. And even, you know, women would fall for him even when he was in his, you know, 60s, 70s, and 80s, and 90s. He just had this wit and charm that was unmistakably magnetic. So you have Vernon, who essentially became the conduit for everything we know also. Because it wasn't just Vernon, you know, Vernon sort of understood, I think, intrinsically, that through the building up of other people and through the storytelling and passing on of lore, that he would then build up his own legend simultaneously. So, I mean, how much would we really know about Mellini or Leipzig? You know, contemporary, you know, Leipzig being a contemporary of Vernon, Mellini sort of being the older person who Vernon knew. You know, and he's passed on these stories to the modern magicians and the modern literature, you know, and talking about other people of that era, Jarrow, you know, Judson Cold, Survey Leroy. I mean, on some of those Revelations tapes, which were the VHS tapes I first encountered Vernon on, and thought to myself, now that guy is a magician. I don't know who these other guys are, you know, which were Michael Amar, Steve Freeman, and Gary Willett. But it was clear to me, being a very, you know, being an absolute neophyte at that time, that clearly Vernon was the magician here. I mean, obviously they were paying him the most attention and these things were about him, but it's just the way he carried himself, his particularness with things, the way he would talk about certain moves and certain presentations and certain, you know, shows and people. In fact, one of those VHS tapes, which have been converted to DVD now, had a real, was just filled with just stories about other magicians that Vernon knew. And so he really built up the legends of other magicians, and in the process, and I think he knew this, built up his own legend. And that is something that is very clever in its understanding, you know. It's like your whole life, if you want to think of it this way, Vernon's whole life was one big magic show. And that's what I think what pisses some people off. You know, I have friends that are Marlowe acolytes, very, very steadfast Marlowe people, and they're often put down Vernon because they view his contributions as his actual contributions, tricks, moves, whatever, being so inferior to Marlowe, who probably wrote more about card, you know, undoubtedly wrote more about card magic than any other person who's ever lived. And most of his contributions people actually use in modern times, even if they don't know it's a Marlowe maneuver, including even coin stuff and other things outside of cards. But Marlowe is not viewed in any light like that, really. Not by the average magician, whereas Vernon is this towering figure of the 20th century. And that I've used as an example to my friend Steve Reynolds, who is a huge Marlowe acolyte, probably knows more about Marlowe than any other living person. And is real, and especially the material that Marlowe put out. It's the reason, you know, Vernon and his storytelling and his understanding of how legends are constructed is the reason why Vernon is the top person in our lifetimes and Marlowe is not. It has very little to do with the actual contributions and has more to do with how you're framing those contributions. And very few people, I think, really understand that in a general sense and in a specific sense when it comes to this. And so you have this the difference between sort of facts, you know, which almost never convince anybody, and then emotions. And Vernon was the best at plucking the emotional heartstrings. Now, the second thing I usually hear about Vernon, and this is, we'll probably get halfway into this, and then we'll continue this next time, is that he was not a professional performer and not a good performer.
Mr. Sims, you don't wear contact lenses, do you?
No, sir.
With your untrammeled sight, whom did you see?
And I think I'm going to, I know I'm going to dispute this, because when I went back and looked up the record, and we watched as much Vernon stuff as I could in preparation for this podcast, one of the things that struck me, which I had not remembered or had not maybe understood before, was how much professional work Guy Vernon had actually done. Because it was pretty well known that Vernon did not aspire to be a professional performer. He said that many times himself in different interviews that are easily accessible. And also, you know, he just would rather, there's many anecdotes of him rather sessioning with other magicians or his friends or hanging out, socializing, than he would rather than to perform. But we do know, when I went back and looked at his sort of track record in performing, that he worked for the top agent in New York City at the time he lived in New York City, Miss Frances Rockefeller King, who also represented like a who's who of society entertainers. And when I rewatched The Spirit of Magic, which was a Canadian documentary made about Di Vernon, there was a short, maybe 5-second clip that I had not remembered seeing previously, where it was where Vernon had said that he had worked for Miss King for 10 or 12 years. And that struck me, looking for more evidence of his professional track record. But that seemed like a hell of a long time to not be a performer, as most people would characterize it.
You're out of order! You're out of order! The whole trial is out of order! They're out of order! That man, that crazy, depraved man, raped him!
So I went back and looked in the old periodicals, and thankfully in the Sphinx, every month during its run, they had a Who's Playing Where column. And thanks to modern technology and search technology, when I analyzed those documents and some other periodicals, it was quickly made clear that Vernon had really done that. He'd worked throughout more than a decade. I think it was, when I counted, it was 13 years. It covered a span of 13 years where he had done dates all over New York and all over the country for Miss King, and was literally working for a who's who of the best people and the top venues in New York City and around the country. I mean, there's stories, George Eastman of Eastman Kodak, you know, all sorts of highfalutin people. And that's a pretty good run for someone who didn't want to be a professional performer to perform for 13 years, basically continuously. You know, he wasn't like he was working every night, but he was taking these dates on a regular basis throughout that entire period. And he was also cutting silhouettes as part of some of those parties and stuff as well. So you have that, right? Which is a lot of performing, actually. So I'm going to call this, he wasn't a professional performer, I'm going to call bullshit on that. Because then you get into a couple of the acts he put together. Now, when he first started working for Mrs. King, someone had suggested to him that he put together what they called an office act, which was almost like a 9-to-5 style job where you would solicit work. It was sort of a salaried position, right? You were sent out on the circuit by the head office and you would sort of work a 9-to-5, you know, thing. And someone had put him in touch with an agent at a theater where Vernon could work out an act, and he had come up with an act that had sleight of hand, it had apparatus, and it ended with this clock dial, which was referred to as an old chestnut. I'm not particularly familiar with this myself, but I guess there was a basically spinning hands on a clock, and this was the crescendo to this little stage act where what Vernon would do is he'd make the hands on the clock on the stage stop at the exact time his performance would end. And this created a fairly dramatic crescendo, and he would say, "My time is up," and he would walk off stage. Now, at the time, that was sort of when he was developing this, this was sort of when the decline of vaudeville. Vaudeville was shifting and in decline. And he ended up not doing that act. And not getting sent out by the head office and so forth. But there is an interesting series of anecdotes where this was during the same period he was developing his act, he encountered T. Nelson Downs, you know, who was an idol of his. And Vernon is known for a lot of things, you know, in magic. But one of them is that he fooled Houdini with basically a trick known as the ambitious card, a version of the ambitious card. Because Houdini at the time had said that if he saw a trick 3 times, he could not be fooled. And Vernon had done this trick, you know, 7 or 8 times and fooled the pants off Houdini, who really wouldn't admit it. And even Houdini's wife had said to Houdini, "You're fooled, just admit it." And so that became something Vernon used in his work at the Rainbow Room and his other high society work. He put it on his business card. So he'd fooled Houdini with this trick. Well, he fooled Downs, T. Nelson Downs, with the exact same trick. And Downs was stunned because Vernon had done a few things for him when they first met on their first encounter and had done some things out of Downs' own book, The Art of Magic, which fooled Downs. Now, Downs had not written that book. It had been ghostwritten, but he had read it, and he actually thought a lot of that stuff didn't really work in real life. But Vernon had fooled him with a few of the things out of there and then told him, that's right out of your book. Didn't you read it? So I thought that was a very funny anecdote. And it was this act with this clock dial finale that Vernon had told Downs he was preparing and rehearsing. And so Downs was like, you know, Downs having been a larger-than-life persona capable of, you know, great stories about Downs holding people with a match trick in a circus ring, you know, in front of a vast audience where they could barely see what was going on or couldn't see what was going on, had this huge, you know, huge personality capable of holding an audience attention. He went to see Vernon rehearse this act and do it a few times in front of audiences and had a very low opinion. When Vernon told him what he was going to do, he had a very low opinion of it. But when he saw Vernon actually do it and had witnessed it for himself, he said to him, Vernon, that's the greatest thing I ever saw in my life. There was a dead silence and the audience was looking at their watches. All you could hear was the swish of the hand. It was beautiful. It was dramatic. And T. Nelson Downs said to Vernon, Vernon, nothing can stop you. You're going right where I went. To where Vernon said, where's that, Tommy? And he said, right to the top. Now that's, didn't come to fruition, actually. But clearly, T. Nelson Downs thought Vernon as a performer was quite remarkable after having seen that. But I don't think Vernon's, it wasn't that he wasn't a great performer, it's just that he didn't aspire to do that. He would rather live a more carefree and reckless lifestyle, perhaps. So the next sort of big act that Vernon put together while he was doing all these dates for Francis Rockefeller King was this, which is another thing people point to, and they sort of have the story wrong, I guess, perhaps, is that he put together this Harlequin act where he dressed up like an old-style clown, and he had this whole act. Now, a lot of people say, oh, you know, he only did it once, and that was a huge failure. That's not actually true. When I looked back into the record, I found out that he actually, that Harlequin act ran for 4 months at the Rainbow Room. So it was actually very successful. Everyone who went to see it thought it was a rave. It got amazing reviews in New York papers. And it's a really a funny story of how all that came into fruition, because Vernon had an idea of throwing a coconut in the air and a monkey appearing dressed as a harlequin as well, which was supposed to be part of the act. And eventually he had to use a dove because the monkey kept, when you threw it up in the air and the monkey appeared, the monkey would start to masturbate and they couldn't stop him. He would just do that when he was in front of a crowd and you couldn't really stop him from doing that. So he had to change it to a dove. And if you go read David Benn's book about Di Vernon, you will see there's a very funny story about the dove. So I highly recommend that book. So Vernon, you know, did this Harlequin act for 4 months at the Rainbow Room to rave reviews. And then, and this is the part that people remember, perhaps, and poo-poo Vernon for, is he did it once at Carnegie Hall. And that's where it bombed, was the one time at Carnegie Hall. It didn't get picked up. He didn't get a return engagement. And really, it was said, it just didn't fit that environment. I mean, the Carnegie Hall is enormous. And the way the act is done and stuff. It just didn't play on such a gigantic stage as that. But it had played on the smaller, sort of more parlor-style stages of the Rainbow Room. So, you know, this Vernon not being a professional performer is just a hokum. You know, it's a perhaps selective amnesia and so forth. And the fact that Vernon himself said he didn't want to do that, and the fact he spent so many years, you know, in his later years, presiding over the Magic Castle. But to me, looking at it from a slightly different perspective, his whole life was the most magical thing, perhaps, that there's ever existed in magic. I mean, who can live such a life like that, having no jobs, really, performing for the society elite, getting rave New York reviews for this weird clown act where you dress like a clown and do magic. And all the reviews of, like, you know, not magicians, but just newspaper reviewers and stuff, just claiming how magical and sensational this stuff he did was. So that's where I'm going to leave it for today. So we've delved into, I think, his whole life was basically a presentation, and the greatest presentation perhaps possible, and also that he was a professional performer. And so we're going to leave the first part of this podcast on that note. When we return next week, we're going to delve into Vernon's skill, his acolytes, who has Vernon influenced, and the direct people who hold him up as an example, you know, that helped them build their own careers, which is basically a who's who, and Vernon's effect on how people do magic nowadays. Well, those are all the sort of topics we'll delve into next time, which will further round out the legend that is Dye Vernon. If you need to reach me, it's d'artagnanmagic.com, d'artagnanmagic on all social media. I have a presentation program that if you don't have a presentation for your magic, and chances are you don't, then you should go over to d'artagnanmagic.com/realmagic, see what I have on offer there. There's lots of things to read and some storytelling over there as well. And we'll be back again with another edition of the podcast, Magic from Wherever I'm At. Until then.